Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not quite the United States of Europe, but maybe it'll work. The latest European debt plan on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 5th of December. Good to have you with us. This is the week that Europe gets its debt mess thing all figured out. No, really. They promise. France and Germany agreed today that they would start drafting a new treaty, one that forces European Union members to be more disciplined and punishes countries that aren't. Part of the goal, of course, is to calm the markets, which have been trashing European bonds. Another part of the goal is to just be done with this thing. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore reports.
For a few hours this morning, the world was happy with a rare burst of action across the Atlantic. France and Germany proposed a plan to draw Europe closer financially. They want to change the European Union's treaty so that countries control their spending or face fines. Italy and Ireland suggested their own austerity measures. It's all a build-up to a European summit this week designed to resolve the continent's debt crisis.
I've personally called it the Hell Week.
That's Lorcan Roche-Kelly with Trend Macrolytics. And that was before the news that Standard & Poor's put 15 Eurozone countries on notice that it may cut their credit ratings. That adds pressure on European leaders. They need a roadmap by Friday.
If they produce just a fudge on Friday evening, it will not be a good day to hold any European exposure next Monday.
France and Germany want to rewrite the European treaty by March. Then every country would have to approve it, and that could take a year, if at all. Kathy Jones is with Charles Schwab. She wonders whether a new treaty would be any more effective at restraining government spending than the current one.
The question, I think, in the marketplace will be, are there really enforcement mechanisms in place? And keep in mind, there's already a treaty that specified that budget deficits should not be more than 3% of GDP, and everyone violated it early on.
So why should we believe European leaders now?
Because they really, really mean it this time, pinky swear.
For now, that's all we've got to go on. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The conventional wisdom is that the euro is in trouble because a bunch of profligate governments have borrowed too much.
Commentator Liaquat Ahmed.
They're now facing enormous difficulties in rolling over their debts. So the proposed solution is government austerity. Unfortunately, the euro's problems go much deeper. The reason that investors have become so unwilling to lend to countries such as Italy has less to do with the size of their debts and much more to do with their growth prospects. Growing countries, like growing companies, have little problem borrowing. It is when growth slows down to a crawl that creditors take fright. Why are the future prospects for growth in southern European countries so bad? Simply put, they have allowed themselves to become severely uncompetitive by allowing their wages to rise too close to German levels without German levels of productivity. If they're to revitalize growth while remaining within the euro, they will have to restructure their economies. The crisis has raised the specter that the euro will fall apart and there will be a return in Greece to the drachma or in Italy to the lira. What does that mean? More trouble. If you're an Italian or Greek corporation, why would you keep your euros in a local bank, not knowing what currency you might eventually get back, when you could shift your money to a German bank and be sure of getting euros back? Not surprisingly, therefore, Greek banks have lost 20% of their deposits over the last year. The bank run has now spread to Italy. So far, the European Central Bank has been willing to act as the lender of last resort by providing hundreds of billions of euros in loans to banks under pressure. Germany will soon have to decide whether it is willing to foot the bill in the event that some of these debts go bad. If this doesn't happen and the European Central Bank is forced to stop its lending, that will be the end of the euro as we know it.
Liaquat Ahmed is the author of Lords of Finance. Send us your thoughts. Marketplace.org is our website. Wall Street's thoughts this Monday were pretty positive, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Beijing, China has the world's second busiest passenger airport, 44 million people a year, except for the past couple of days. A combination of heavy smog and what the government is officially calling fog grounded hundreds of flights today. Thousands of passengers were left to their own devices. But even if you weren't directly affected, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports the pollution over there is starting to make its way here.
The fog was so bad in northern China, they closed down roads. Mix in Beijing's notoriously heavy smog, and China got a soupy brown haze that limited pilot visibility and made flying dangerous. One Chinese blogger said the skies got so dark, it looked like the end of the world. China scholar Elizabeth Economy says she's not surprised.
Frankly speaking, this has been taking place for over two decades now. I mean, they were closing the airport back in 1990 because of pollution levels.
But Economy says Chinese officials are under increasing fire for underreporting pollution levels. The U.S. Embassy is making its own measurements now, and U.S. scientists are delving into the impact of Asia's pollution on this country. Dan Jaffe is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Washington.
We now know that, especially along the West Coast, all the way from California and Washington to the Rocky Mountains, that Asia makes a significant contribution to the number of days that exceed the air quality standards.
Scientists believe Asia's contributing somewhere between 5 to 10% of the ozone in the U.S., and all our ozone adds up to $11 billion in yearly medical costs. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The second and final week of the Global Summit on Climate Change in Durban, South Africa starts today. And in case you haven't been paying super close attention, well, maybe this will do it. New numbers released this weekend show that carbon dioxide emissions around the world, that is carbon dioxide, the most common greenhouse gas, have shot through the roof. European and Chinese negotiators have been suggesting an eventual binding deal to cut those gas emissions in 3 years at the earliest. And a lot of countries are playing the you go first card, so nobody expects a comprehensive agreement by week's end. Still, energy markets are getting ready for change. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
The brown energy industry, as in oil, gas, and coal, has been around way longer than the green energy industry. Brown is cheaper, and it gets six times more subsidies. So with climate talks in the slow lane, bet on brown, right? Not exactly. Last year, for the first time ever, more investment actually poured into renewable power. Like this solar panel farm being installed in New Jersey. Bloomberg New Energy Finance says green attracted $187 billion in 2010. That's 20% more than brown.
Renewables has gone from a very immature industry to becoming, in its own right, a substantial global business.
That's Pulitzer Energy writer Dan Yergin. His new book is The Quest.
You have had a series of very strong financial incentives from governments that are driving the growing role for renewables. In the United States, utilities must get a certain percentage of their electricity from renewables.
Governments are pushing it. Technology is pulling it along. And then you have good old self-interest. Nick Robbins is with the bank HSBC.
For example, resource scarcity, increasing water scarcity, which does put constraints on the amount of conventional power generation you can have. So I think deployment of renewables makes sense strategically. And also then you have the energy security issues.
He thinks the world's $200 billion clean energy market may double in a generation. And that means opportunity for the historic innovators, the rich countries, right? Robbins actually thinks the emerging market investments will lead the world. South Africa is mulling a fossil fuel tax, which makes the alternatives more competitive. Brazil plans to triple its green power. And China Inc., it's investing on the hope that clean tech is the next big thing.
These economies in East Asia have generally followed the Western model from heavy industry and steel, shipbuilding, autos, into electronics and so on. When they're looking forward and saying, well, where are the next sources of our growth? You look at this low-carbon economy, clean technology and so on.
By Bloomberg's reckoning, developing countries invest more in renewables now than the rich ones, like America, which remains addicted to imported oil, right? Not so much. Here's Fatih Birol at the International Energy Agency.
The picture is changing, and the picture is changing very rapidly. According to our analysis, U.S. oil imports are going to decline substantially.
Right now, we bring in 13 million barrels of oil every day. The IEA thinks those imports will shrink in half by 2035. Our cars are more efficient. We're drilling more for our own fossil fuels. The big rage is natural gas. Sharif Suki runs the Houston energy firm Cheniere. He says, we don't even know how much we have.
When you ask the producers, how big do you think it's going to be? They're very uncomfortable giving you the answer because it's still work in progress. But you can see that they're smiling when they're telling you that because they keep thinking it gets bigger every year.
America is swimming in billions of cubic feet of natural gas, or BCF.
Every BCF is 50,000 jobs. Every BCF helps us raise $3 or $4 billion that we can then use to pay the oil.
But the energy business is full of risk. Will the banks lend to the exporters? Is natural gas drilling safe for the environment? Will other countries find their own and not need ours? These are all 20, 30-year bets based on assumptions. And every so often, those long-held assumptions are wrong. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We had a spirited conversation at our news meeting this morning about the Xbox and an announcement about it out today. Not about its share of Microsoft's revenue or the latest sales of video games, but as a way to just watch TV. The game console will do what, for most of us, a set-top box does. And there was only one guy around the room, in the whole room, our morning producer, Ethan Lindsay, who understood exactly how it works. So we dragged him into the studio to explain. Here you go.
I don't own a single video game. I'm not even a gamer. But I can use my Xbox to get college football games, Netflix, Hulu, HBO. Basically, anything you can get on a normal TV, you can get on an Xbox, and you're just not using it as an Xbox.
So we got our technology reporter, Steve Henn, on the line to make sense of all this stuff. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So you heard the tape, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so why is Microsoft and Xbox making these changes?
Well, you know, this is their bid to get into the living room. You know, as Ethan already discovered, he can watch ESPN, he can watch all these other channels, and Microsoft is adding HBO Go, Xfinity, YouTube, Major League Baseball. And so I spoke to Ron Honey, the GM of Xbox Entertainment and Advertising Division, yeah. And this is what he said.
So our vision here is to aggregate as much content as possible that our users want to watch all on the Xbox.
All right, but aren't you just swapping out one box on top of your TV for another box on top of your TV?
Well, kind of. You know, and at this point, Xbox can't deliver everything. So it's not going to scan through all of your 250 cable channels and find shows on that. But in some ways, it's even bigger than that. It could change the way you interact with your TV. So instead of using a remote, you could use, if you have Xbox Kinect, voice commands or hand gestures. So let's say you want to watch a William Macy movie. You can just walk into your living room, say, Xbox, Bing William Macy, and it will show every movie that Macy is in, from, you know, Tale of Despero to Fargo. And it'll show you like three or four different ways to watch it, like what's available on Netflix, what you can get from Zune through Microsoft and other things as well. So it's going to change how we search for television. And that actually is just the beginning. You know, Kinect has artificial intelligence built in. So
yeah, because that's all we need with our TVs.
Right, that's right. A TV that's smarter than you. But it will be able to tell if it's you in the living room or your kid.
Wow.
It could tell if you're paying attention to the ad it's showing you, right? So advertisers potentially would love this. You know, it's a much better way to measure whether an ad's effective or not.
Give me a sense of scale, though, Steve, because this sounds like technically complicated and like it makes sense to about 14 people in the whole universe.
Well, you know, it can't be that technically complicated. I was talking to some analysts, and something like 10 million people in the United States are already doing it. I haven't set one up in my living room, but you hear that half of all data traveling over the internet during primetime television watching hours is Netflix streaming.
Yeah.
Well, apparently half of that is actually streaming to an Xbox. So it's already huge before they've added all this new content.
Does that mean that the days of the Scientific Atlanta set-top boxes that we all have now are soon to be gone?
Yeah, the days may be numbered. You know, the cable companies don't really love the set-top box business. Hmm. They'd like to get out of it. This might be one cheap, easy way for them to do that. So stay tuned.
Boom, boom. Stay tuned. Steve Henn. Thank you, Steve.
Sure thing.
Coming up, China imports lots of things, including, apparently, the troubles of the Eurozone. But first, let's do the numbers. Europe, Europe, Europe. Marcia, Marcia, Marcia. That's what was on traders' minds today. The Dow Industrials rose 78 points, 2/3 of 1%, closed at 12,097. The NASDAQ gained 28 points, 1.1%, 2,655. The S&P 500 jumped up 12 points, 1%. Ended things at 1,257. Stocks soared on that agreement between Germany and France that we told you about earlier, and then they gave some back. Morgan Stanley shares deposited 6 2/3%. Citigroup surged almost 6%. Bank of America and Wells Fargo each picked up more than 2.5%. Today, FedEx rang up a gain of 1.25%. The company said it's going to increase rates for FedEx ground and home delivery on January 2nd. Nice timing. UPS moved up 1 2/10%. Why? Well, that's coming up later in the broadcast, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Athletic Trainers Association holds a youth sports safety summit. The focus is the prevention of fatal injuries. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner travels to Europe, where he'll meet with officials about the region's debt problems. And on December 6, 1865, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified. It abolished slavery. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today, the United States Postal Service laid out the cost-cutting plan that pretty much everybody knew was coming. The post office is about this close to bankruptcy, so it wants to close more than 200 mail processing facilities across the country, wants to do away with next-day delivery of first-class mail, and it wants to lay off 30,000 people, provided it can convince regulators to let it do that. In all, it would amount to about $3 billion in savings. But with email and online banking and all the other trimmings of digital life, what's the hope for snail mail anyway? From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
I wonder who's writing letters these days, who's shopping with catalogs, paying the rent with checks. I asked lawyer David Hendel, who needs first-class mail?
Everybody.
Hendel used to work for the U.S. Postal Service. Now he's in private practice. And he says reports of the death of the mail are premature.
Now, we're going to have less of it, but it's still the single best way to reach individuals in their homes.
In most corners of this country, a letter carrier comes to your house or apartment once a day, 6 days a week. Gene Del Polito is president of the Association for Postal Commerce, a group that represents companies that use the mail to do business.
The fact of the matter is the Postal Service still carries each year 140 billion pieces of mail.
The amount of first-class mail, letters and postcards, has been on the decline. But millions of Americans still rely on the Postal Service to get movies, medicine, contact lenses, heartworm pills. In the future, it may take an extra day or two to get the product, but it's still convenient and relatively cheap. And Del Polito says there are Luddites among us, Americans who, by choice or circumstance, aren't banking online.
Who doesn't have internet access? Who chooses not to be able to make those payments or receive those bills electronically?
The way we use the mail will continue to change, and the Postal Service knows that. There's already competition for overnight delivery. But odds are Americans will still use the Postal Service for things that aren't as time-sensitive, for newspapers and magazines, postcards, and Christmas cards. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Prisoner number 62785-054 reported to a federal medical center in Massachusetts today. If he serves his full sentence, Raj Rajaratnam is going to be behind bars for the next 11 years. The founder of the Galleon Group of hedge funds was convicted of insider trading a couple of months ago. Now, he's going to be a totally different kind of insider. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Raj Rajaratnam is now in a federal prison in Ayer, Massachusetts. It has a hospital wing. He has diabetes. Ed Bales heads Federal Prison Consultants. He says Rajaratnam, a former billionaire, will be using the black market currency of prison stamps and packets of dried mackerel from the commissary.
They eat it or they trade it for something else of other value. So you'd be surprised. It's a very interesting environment.
An environment surrounded by razor wire and armed guards. Rajaratnam could be transferred to a low-security prison camp next to the main prison, but it wouldn't be any paradise.
There's no such thing as cop fed anymore.
Alan Ellis is an attorney specializing in white-collar sentencing. He says in the 70s, the public heard stories about Watergate players being pampered in prison camps. Then Hollywood got into the act.
There was a film called Goodfellas, and it showed these mafia inmates basically feasting on lobster and steak that they had shipped in from the outside.
In prison, dinner was always a big thing. We had a pasta course, and then we had a meat or a fish.
Five of the cushiest prison camps were eventually closed. Larry Levine was in one in the 90s.
I was like an efficiency expert for organized crime. I was working with some of our Italian friends.
Levine says things have changed a lot in the camp since he did his time.
They were letting people order in their own food. They don't have that anymore. I mean, just little things, other than, let's say, the golf courses and the swimming pools that they took away.
But Levine says camps are still much better than higher security prisons. With just one guard for every 100 inmates, camp rules can be bent. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This has been a very Euro-heavy day in what will be a very Euro-heavy week. That big meeting Friday is either going to wrap things up or it won't. But for all the talk of how the Eurozone debt crisis is affecting Europe and us, we're not the only games in town, you know. We've heard scarce little through this whole thing about Asia. Economic growth there has been brisk, so problems in the EU are kind of a mixed bag. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has that story.
It's not that Asian economies aren't closely following what's unfolding in Europe. It's just that some of them are distracted by themselves.
China is the golden market.
Yang Fenghui sees a shift in economic power towards Asia. He's been waiting for this moment for years. Yang hooks up investors from Finland with companies in China and Chinese investors with clean tech companies in Finland.
Everyone in China is now talking about sustainable development and the green economy. But our technology level in somehow many fields are not as advanced as some other developed countries.
Developed countries like Finland. Yang's Shanghai office is specially designed for Finnish investors. There's a sauna in between the cubicles where Finnish businessmen can wrap towels around themselves and escape the worries of the European debt crisis back home. Here they can search for business opportunities in an economy that isn't in free fall. But don't get too comfortable. Economist Arthur Kroeber says there are tough days ahead for Asia.
So we have a dual effect. One is that a big export market is seeing slowing demand, and so that's hurting exporters throughout the region. And then the availability of trade finance is also drying up because the European banks are scrambling.
Scrambling to prepare for the losses they'll likely take from their holdings of risky European bonds. That means less credit for Asian economies. European banks lend twice as much to Asia as they do to the U.S. and Japan put together. China's the heavyweight of the Asian economies. It bailed out the region with $500 billion stimulus plan after the crash in 2008. Kroeber says it can't afford to do that again, and that probably means tough times ahead for Southeast Asian countries. But Kroeber says China is better positioned today than it used to be for a crisis like this.
If you go back 10 years, mainly what China was doing was exporting consumer goods to Europe and the United States.
But over the past decade, its strategy has evolved. China spent a lot of money developing infrastructure inside the country, and that's created spin-off companies that can build infrastructure at low cost overseas.
And what they're increasingly doing now is exporting capital goods like construction equipment, power generation equipment, telecoms network equipment, and so forth. And those exports are mainly going to India, Brazil, Indonesia, developing countries that have huge unmet infrastructure needs.
In the meantime, the consuming class in China and the rest of Asia is growing, and that's good news for popular American and European retail brands. The question is, do consumers in Asia have the buying power to rescue the West? In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which you heard about in Heidi's story at the beginning of the broadcast, rumors that S&P would put France, Germany, and 13 other Eurozone countries on watch for a credit downgrade, basically the whole Eurozone economy. It was finally confirmed after the bell in New York, but stay with me here for a minute because this could actually be a good thing. And here's how. You remember when our credit rating was downgraded this past summer? Yeah, well, it's actually cheaper for the United States to borrow now than it was then. So go figure that out. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow rose 78 points, 0.2%, 12,097 at the bell. The NASDAQ gained 28 points, 1.1%, finished at 2655. The S&P 500 jumped 12 points, 1%, ended things at 1,257. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up back here next time, we start our philanthropy series, How We Give and Why.
Since I don't have enough room here to make mistakes, what is the one charity that really has the evidence behind it for being effective?
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.